There we go. Call the House Judiciary Committee to order, March 10th, 2011. We also have a maximum number of people in the room after the chairs are full of about seven or eight. No, I will not ask him to leave. I didn't mention the name, though. We're going to start out with House Bill 3393 first. Representative Escobar had asked to get going.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3393 pertains to some very old Oregon statutes and what is commonly known as Oregon and California, or ONC, grant lands. These lands came into existence shortly after the Civil War as part of an effort by the federal government to encourage the expansion of railways. That ultimately led to litigation, which caused the land that had been granted to the railways to be returned to the federal government. That happened pursuant to the Oregon and California Revestment Act of June 9, 1916. They further consolidated their management of those lands in the Oregon and California Lands Act of August 28, 1937. House Bill 3393 specifies that the state of Oregon asserts title to and possession of all federal lands known as the ONC grant lands, the Oregon and California grant lands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6, and from an ONC county. First of all, thanks for having us here today and letting us discuss this bill. This actually started back in 1836 when the first sawmill started, and it's been progressing ever since. This land was taken from and actually given to the federal government on the assumption that we would have an Oregon-California railroad that would pass through. So we had sections of land that were given to this right-of-way with the stipulation that we would be able to harvest the timber and give a certain amount of percentage of the timber monies and proceeds to the counties, which in turn helps our schools as well. This was went along for quite some time until such time that we have curtailed the harvest of timber in the state of Oregon to the point of where it didn't actually do much for the counties. The federal government then at that point allowed or told us they would pay us monies for the loss of revenue from timber harvest. Well, that went along for, I think, 6 or 8 years, maybe 10. Now that's declining and going to be shut off shortly. So this bill actually demands that the federal government give back the ONC lands that they had taken. And, of course, you cannot take back the lands that were sold off because at one time they were selling off lands for timber harvest to private entities and for homesteading. But this bill will allow the state of Oregon to have control and sovereignty over ONC lands. Why is this important to the ONC counties? I'm going to use not my county, because my county has prepared for this, I think, fairly well. But I'm going to use Representative Hicks's county and Representative Krieger's county. It's an integral part of their general fund dollars. Without this, the last time we had this dry up, this revenue stream dry up, I believe in Representative Hicks's county, they gave out 43 pink slips to the sheriff's department. So your law enforcement will virtually go away, and I believe it's 60-some percent of the general fund in Curry County, where Representative Krieger comes from. So these are very imperative dollars to ONC counties, and my feeling is if the federal government makes a deal, they should follow through with it. If they aren't going to follow through with it, then they should give it back to the sovereignty of the state of Oregon and let us deal with it. Let us establish a harvest plan that we can live with, maybe a 75-year. I'm not sure what the base is on this, but I'm sure it would probably be 75 years plus, where we could log this land perpetual without ever getting into any other lands, and we would reap from that harvest. So I've kind of given you an overview of it. I'll turn this over to Jim.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I work for Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade group that represents about 1,000 contract logging companies and firms associated with the logging industry in Oregon. I'd like to start by commending Representative Esquivel for taking the lead on House Bill 3393. If nothing else, this is a statement from the legislature expressing concern about how the federal forests in Oregon are being managed. I'd like to point out as well the broad bipartisan support in the way of co-sponsors for this bill, the way Democrats and Republicans from Portland to Southern Oregon, from the coast to Eastern Oregon. It's a very impressive list of co-sponsors, and I think it demonstrates the concern that this body has for how our federal forests are managed. The federal government owns 60% of the forest lands in Oregon, 60% of some 30.5 million acres. 2.5 million acres are controlled by the Bureau of Land Management. And as Representative Esquivel pointed out, for many, many decades, these forest lands generated tremendous revenues for the counties that depend on our industry, the 18 ONC counties. These lands were not intensively managed until after World War II, when the baby boomers came back from the war and housing demand increased dramatically. For over 50 years, these lands produced 1.1 billion board feet of timber year in and year out. The BLM's inventory data indicates that they started out with about 51 or 52 billion board feet of standing inventory. Today, after 5 decades of harvesting 1.1 billion feet a year, there's over 70 billion board feet of inventory on these lands. They have been managed sustainably. They've been managed very prudently. Now, as far as the counties go, the law specifies that they are to receive 75% of the timber revenues from these lands. Several decades ago, they voluntarily agreed to plow back one-third of their share into managing the lands more intensively for the future. And I think one of the things that should weigh heavy on this committee and the legislature is that is a broken deal that the federal government made with these counties. They have given up substantial revenues to plan for the future, and now that future has been, the rug has been pulled right out from underneath them. All of this prosperity came to a screeching halt when the spotted owl was listed in 1990. And subsequent to that, the Clinton administration developed the Northwest Forest Plan. Under the Northwest Forest Plan, the ONC lands are basically managed as if they were national forests, even though the law clearly states, and the Ninth Circuit Court has even agreed, that timber production is to be the dominant use of these lands to sustain timber-dependent communities in Western Oregon. The Clinton administration's plan reduced that 1.1 billion board foot harvest level down to 220 million board feet, a level that has never been attained in the 15 or 16 years that that plan has been in place. Under the Bush administration, the BLM embarked on a new planning process to revise the Northwest Forest Plan, something they're legally required to do every 10 to 15 years. That effort was called the Western Oregon Plan Revision, commonly known as the WOPR. After 5 years and millions of dollars of an investment, they produced a plan that would have produced about 500 million board feet per year, stayed completely out of stands over 160 years old, set aside half of the land for fish, water, and wildlife, and the other half for timber production. One of the first actions that the Obama administration took under the leadership of the new Interior Secretary Ken Salazar was to unilaterally withdraw that plan. It never was implemented. And today, the BLM is a rudderless ship. By no fault of their professional staff people, they have very qualified, good people working in the BLM, but because of politics, it is a rudderless ship, and they do not know what is expected of them in the way of producing timber. And the counties are left in the lurch. Since the early 90s, they've been getting direct subsidies from the federal government, from the taxpayers, to replace the funds that used to be generated by managing a renewable timber resource. That gravy train is scheduled to end at the end of this year, 2011. Now, depending on what political pundit you want to believe, the opinions range from that bill not being reauthorized, worst case, to a best case of being reauthorized at a much lower level than what it's been in the past. And the counties that Representative Esquivel referred to are desperate. A lot of these counties rely to the tune of 60 to 65% of their revenues from these BLM lands. There's money growing on trees in Oregon, ladies and gentlemen, and we can manage those forests in a very responsible way and come very close to replacing the revenue that has been lost by the gridlock that's been affecting these lands since 1993. So I would implore you to pass House Bill 3393, send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. If for no other reason, to make a statement to our federal government about what our expectations are for managing these forests. When you think about it, 2.5 million acres is only 8% of the forest lands in Oregon. Yet for 50 years, they've been the economic backbone of 18 Western Oregon counties. That doesn't have to go away. Is the pendulum going to swing back to where it was? No. But is there room for improvement? Absolutely. And I think this committee is an excellent place to begin expressing that concern and not just encouraging but demanding that our federal government do a better job of managing these forests. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
President Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for bringing this forward. Nobody's going to hear anything they haven't heard before, but unfortunately, state nullification of federal policy hasn't had a very good track record in this country, going back to the Marshall Court. But I got to tell you, you're right, we have to make a statement. You know, one thing I like about this is a natural resources bill and a judiciary committee. We have a room full of service providers here, and they, every single one of them, to a person, wants more money for public safety. Guess what, folks? Here it is, right here. You want more money? You know what? You want more money? You better start helping these guys right here, because this is where the money is. And you know what? I hear opponents of logging in this state gleefully tell me, well, there's no market for the lumber, representative. And you know what? At the time, they're right. Right now, they're right. But they're gleeful about it, and they're smug about it, and I'm sick of listening to them. And you know what? We do have to make a statement. We manage our state lands better than the federal government does. They need to let us back on there. And, you know, I've also heard, well, those counties, they need to tax themselves. Well, you know, when you got 20, 25, 30% unemployment, who are we going to tax? There's no one to tax. There's nobody left to tax. You need to let them have good people that know how to manage this land in an environmentally, economically, socially sustainable way, get back out there, and we need to start being responsible. Because you're right, the money's growing on trees, it's running in the river, it's on arable land. We're dripping with wealth in this state, and this government is irresponsible with it, and we're starving on the vine. Thank you very much. The good bill should pass or drive over.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also in the category of things that have been said before but bear repeating, I continue to be extremely concerned about the proposed Siskiyou National Monument that's going to absorb roughly half of my district. I am very skeptical about this particular administration's approach to this issue. The fact that the BLM has received no discernible direction only leads me to believe more that it's intending to designate a huge swath of Oregon as a national monument, thus cutting off this option to us forever, and I dare suggest, in their opinion, eliminating their sense of obligation to live up to the ONC contract. In other words, they got to pay if it's a forest, but probably not if it's a national monument. And so not only is the option of turning it back into arable forest land going to go off the table, but so will the in one fell swoop, or signature, that is to say, of the administration, so will the obligation, as the federal government sees it, to live up to its side of the ONC contract and continue with those funds. As far as why the counties cannot afford to stay really solvent, you know, back when in Measure 5, Measure 50, when the property tax rate was frozen in Josephine County, it was frozen at 57 cents. And that was a time of great prosperity. That tells us that things were so good back then that people only had to pay, because there was so much wealth abounding, 57 cents per thousand. Now, of course, our industry is gone. Our source of revenue is vanished. And 57 cents is not going to provide the basic level of public service that the governments are founded initially to provide. So I wanted to put that out there for the witnesses in the group that this is we're at a bad point on this issue, and I am very, very concerned that we're only going to get worse.
Anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, when we, I want to see if I can rally the troops here for you, gentlemen, because I feel badly that over the last 15 or 20 years that you guys have been sounding the alarm and there haven't been a lot of people around to help. And I'd like to echo Representative Schaffler. You know, every time there's a tax increase proposal that comes down, we've got a whole host of groups that come out in favor of that tax increase. And they talk about teachers and services and places where the tax increase money can go, good works that the tax revenues can go to. But when folks like you come out and ask for the right and the ability to go to work, which will also support our social safety net, and which will also support education, you guys look around and it's awful quiet. And I'd like to suggest that it's time for us in the metro area to look around in a very serious way about whether we can continue to increase taxes to the exclusion of creating jobs as the only way to solve our economic problems. It's not the only way. It really isn't. And it's time for us to move forward and create jobs in just this manner. Thank you.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair, may I say one other thing? What this has also done to counties, ONC counties, is imagine having a baseball team. You have 9 players on the team. When you took the timber industry out of the lineup, you took the 400 hitter out, and you inserted a retail commercial service 165 hitter. So you've dropped your economic vitality and economic doability of your whole county. Example, in 1970, when I was working my way through college, I was pulling green chain, veneer green chain, and I received $3.74 an hour, which doesn't sound like much, but if you take that out over today, through inflation from 1970 to today, it's over $19 an hour. That was the starting place. That's what we've done to our economy. So as long as we let the tail wag the dog in this state, we're going to have problems. And we desperately need it in our ONC counties. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. After Representative Schaffer spoke, I find it unnecessary to add anything. He says it all, and he says it eloquently, and he says it often, and that's what we all need to be doing. Thank you. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3393. If you're going to testify, yes, today, but please sign up, because we can't open and close meetings and have people running in and out of this room who are legislators, and we're trying to get our agenda fixed. So we're going to take everything in order after you testify. Reopen 3393.
Thank you. Co-chairs Krieger, Barker, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I will be brief. I'm handing out some information that I think just backs up, so you've got it in your hands, the importance of the ONC revenue to Oregon's counties, specifically Lane County. There's information in there about all of the ONC counties, but also the importance of this revenue to Lane County specifically. I'd echo Representative Hicks, your comments about the state of affairs in counties. If you look at your third chart there, you'll see that the very peak of revenue from timber in Oregon, at least over the last 40 years, occurred in 1990, which was precisely when we were presented with the tax cap measures in the state of Oregon. And really, the final thing that I would remind the committee of here, I'm sure that the Association of Oregon Counties has probably visited with each of you and provided you with a shared services chart. This should look familiar, and it shows the partnership that counties have with the state in terms of providing services to our citizens. Without the revenue from the ONC, okay, which goes just right into the general fund, purely discretionary dollars for the ONC counties, these services get harder and harder for us to provide. And the responsibility then falls to the state. That's the partnership where we need to work on this jointly. And I'd submit to you, there's fascinating histories about the ONC lands. Fascinating. And in every case, you'll see over the past past century, the Oregon legislature has played a role in sending a message to Congress about this. And while the Board of County Commissioners hasn't had the time to take a position on this bill, so I'm providing you this as information only, I'd ask you to recall that the Oregon legislature has played a key role in influencing Congress as to the management of these lands. And the bill in front of you may have some issues, but it's a very interesting sort of footnote in the history of the ONC and the relationship that the Oregon legislature has had with the United States Congress about the management of these lands. Thank you, sir.
Questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on 3393. But there's only one person signed up on 2103. Is there anyone else that wanted to sign up on that one? We will open a public hearing on 2103. Karen Wheeler, she here?
There she is. And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2103 would allow an individual who has been either convicted of DUII or who is in the is participating in a DUII diversion program to use third-party resources to pay for the cost of treatment, screening, interview, and subsequent treatment.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2103, and the purpose of the bill is to clarify that people who are convicted of a driving under the influence of intoxicants or are under a diversion agreement may use their third-party benefit to pay for the costs of screening, assessments, and treatment. A majority of the people who are convicted or arrested on a DUII have an alcohol or drug problem requiring intervention. Unfortunately, many of these people do not seek treatment until it's too late and there's a crisis or a negative consequence in their lives. Hence, many folks do get a DUII. Financial barriers are one of the primary reasons people avoid either seeking treatment or leave treatment too early. This bill would remove financial barriers for those who have a medical benefit and who also have a diagnosable substance-related illness. Currently, the statute does not include permissive language related to the use of health benefit plans to cover these services when an individual has a DUII. The statute does refer to the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund as a source of payment and also references the individual paying his or her own fees. This is being interpreted by some health plans to mean that addiction services are not a covered benefit when people are referred to these services by a court. With 20 to 22,000 DUI referrals coming into the treatment system annually, the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund represents a fraction of what would be needed to assist those who are unable to pay. It should not matter how a person comes to treatment, but that they have a legitimate medical condition for which there are a set of services covered by their health benefit plan. And that is my short and brief testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or be a resource to the committee.
Committee members, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, thank you so much for bringing this forward to us. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying, that currently, even if somebody has health insurance, they cannot use the health insurance to get treatment for addictions and mental health if they've been ordered to do so by a court after they've had a DUI. Is that right?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Tomei, sometimes plans don't want to pay, and they cite the statute as it's currently written. However, other times plans do pay. So the purpose of this bill is to just clarify policy that it is allowable for a person to use their third-party benefit, whether that be the Oregon Health Plan or other health insurance plan, to pay for treatment when they truly have a diagnosable condition.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Schaffer.
Thank you. So they would be allowed to, or they would have to pay? And one more, the industry isn't here. You're the only one signed up, and usually their hair's on fire if they're against something. Are they squared away with all this? So, and would they have to pay, or they may pay?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Schaffer. They would be allowed to pay. And this bill, the current statute, wouldn't be a barrier. And I haven't heard any resistance to the bill. That doesn't mean there isn't any. I just haven't heard any resistance or opposition.
Follow up, went up quickly. If you had a plan and it was questionable, the interpretation was questionable, would they have to pay or just allow to pay? I want to make sure I get this right. It would allow them to do something some of them are already doing now.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Schaffler, they would be allowed to pay.
Okay, thank you.
Karen, if it says if it's a defined benefit of the plan and you take this barrier away, it's like any other benefit. They should be required
Correct.
To pay if there isn't an impediment in the statute.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Co-chair Krieger, I'm sorry. Sometimes people do not have a diagnosis. So people who get a DUII may or may not have a diagnosable substance use disorder, whether it's abuse or dependence.
All right.
Sometimes they've gotten a DUI and they do not have a diagnosis at all. In that case, a health plan is not going to pay for the treatment or services. But when a plan is already capitated or they've received payment to cover that life within their membership, they've been paid to provide those medical services when somebody truly, in fact, has a diagnosis. And this actually relates to the hearing you just had. When people are not able to get their health benefit to pay for their treatment, counties and the state end up paying for that treatment. So there is somewhat of a relationship to the county budget.
Representative Schaffer is going to tell you if we cut more trees, we'll be able to pay for
Amen.
It.
And coming from a family of loggers and mill workers, that sounds good to me. From Curry County, I might add.
I think we're finished, aren't we? Thank you very much,
Thank
Karen.
You.
Close the public hearing on 2103. Open a public hearing on 3186. And I think we have a Representative Berger.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3186 removes the exception for persons operating a motor vehicle within the scope of their employment from the general offense of operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile communication device. It's important for members of the committee to be aware that I am in possession of two amendments, and I hope that they have both been made available to you. The first amendment, labeled -2, would create an exception within this bill for individuals who activate or deactivate a mobile communication device or function of the device if the person is operating a tow vehicle or roadside assistance vehicle while acting in the scope of their employment. The -3 amendment would also craft out an exception, this covering a person operating a vehicle owned or contracted by a utility for the purpose of installing, repairing, maintaining, operating, or upgrading utility service, and then the usual gas, electricity, water, or telecommunications.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
I looked up and I had two people sitting
there. Yeah, well, I have a friend with me. Representative, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, nice to see you this afternoon, and I appreciate your attention to this bill. The good representative from Milwaukee and I and Representative Schaffler were all on the Transportation Committee last session, and Carolyn Tomei sponsored a bill with... Well, he's not on this committee. Representative Esquivel,
right.
That basically required that we use hands-free when we use a cell phone in our cars in Oregon. It was a bill I voted against before I voted for. I need to put that on the record. But what really changed my mind about it was this issue of texting.
Unfortunately, the bill is written, and Legislative Council felt that this was the way to write it, in basically some exception language. In other words, you can't use a cell phone while you're driving except in these certain cases. And one of the cases that was in there, and we had a lot of discussion about it at the time, that was around operating a vehicle while in the scope of a person's employment. And what we meant by that, and I can tell you we were in the conversation, was the things that are in today's exceptions, which is tow vehicles, electric utility vehicles, vehicles that were actually out on the highway in the scope of doing professional work that they might need a cell phone for. I don't think we needed to accept them out. But unfortunately, the language didn't make that very clear. And I got an email, and maybe some of you did, from the chief from Gerhard saying, I can't enforce this written the way it is. And I went back and looked at it and said, of course he can't. It says the scope of a person's employment. He could pull somebody over and they go to the judge and say, well, I'm a realtor. I need my cell phone. And it's an argument that could be made. Now, whether the judge buys it or not is another thing, but it came to me that we needed to clean up this language. And so I proposed the original bill, which is House Bill 3186, which basically just opted that language right out of the law. In the meantime, here in Salem we had a true tragedy, and I have submitted to you testimony of a woman by the name of Michelle Singer from here in Salem, and I would ask you to take time today to read her testimony. She couldn't be here. But her brother, a 37-year-old father of three, was killed by a hit-and-run driver a few months ago. It was one of those tragedies on all kinds of levels, and it was hit and run, and nobody knew. And about a week later, a young man turned himself in and said, I was hit and run, and I was texting. And it just hit me between the eyes. Two families' lives have been ruined because somebody was not paying attention and they were texting. And in the meantime, I had this bill before me, and I realized that in the original language, texting was also in the exception. In other words, all that exception language of when you could use a cell phone included texting. And that's when I said, we've got to really change this to get the texting out of the exception language. Therefore, I bring you -2 amendments to House Bill 3186. It is some cleanup of the original language, and it is also takes the texting portion out of the exception language. It also adds back in one of the professions, if you will, that I think it's okay, and I am accepting of this, is operating a tow vehicle and roadside assistance vehicle while acting in the scope of the person's employment is acceptable language, because that's the kind of thing we meant in this exception language. I understand that there is a dash, probably,
there's a limit of three.
Four, that I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it exists, and since we're not moving the bill, we can get to it later, that I would be accepting of, that says similar thing if you're out working on our electrical power lines and need to use a cell phone. But let me make myself clear. I mean using a cell phone, not texting. I don't want exception for texting. I can't imagine how you could drive a car and text. If someone can bring me an excuse for it, I'd be willing to listen, but you'd have to talk long and hard, because I have, now that I've learned to text, I don't see how you can do both, drive a car responsibly and operate any kind of a texting situation. Now, would it prevent tragedy if we had this law? Probably not, but I think we need to be very, very clear in enforcement and to the citizens that this is unacceptable in Oregon. And so that's why I bring you this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. I want to thank Representative Berger for doing this. She is clearing up. I also heard from the chief from Gerhardt and from other folks who were trying to enforce this legislation that we had passed. We had met long and hard with all the stakeholders about who wanted to be included and excluded from this cell phone law. So we worked really hard, and in doing that, we did cut an exception that you could drive a truck through. So, as I said, I was the chief sponsor of this bill, along with the good representative from Medford, which prohibits talking on its handheld cell phone while driving. After numerous meetings, as I say, with the stakeholders, we developed this list of exceptions. And we were very clear, this did, when in text, on the floor and in the committee meetings, this did not mean legislators, did not mean you and me, it did not mean realtors, it did not mean salespersons. We made it really clear about what exceptions. So, of course, we can't expect judges from Gearhart or anywhere else to come and look at the exceptions that we had intended. So I guess that's all I have to say, except because of the ambiguity of the original law, enforcement is inconsistent, and again, I applaud Representative Berger for following up and make a better bill than the good one that we passed 2 years ago.
And if you'd allow me one more point, it is the dash two. I have read the one that's not coming that puts in the utility vehicles. But I would commend that in the dash 2 it says is operating a tow vehicle or roadside assistance vehicle while acting in the scope of a person's employment. I want it on the record that I support that because, to our great delight, Mr. Craig Campbell, who is the proponent of that, is unable to speak today, so I get to speak for him, and we have a silent Campbell in the room.
Ooh.
Which one is it?
Only one. I can only do one.
Oh, he is here.
Any questions?
No.
Hey,
what's that?
Thank you, co-chairs, Chair Krieger. First of all, I'd like to note that we do have the dash 3 amendment that pertains to utilities. Dash 4 threw me off. I did have a question. You said that in under no circumstance that you would envision texting being applicable as an exception. And I note mobile communication device means a text messaging device or wireless two-way communication device designed to receive or transmit voice or text communication. I suppose my concern there, particularly with some of the exceptions that we've laid out for utilities and tow operators, is that increasingly they use two-way dispatch systems that involve the sending of text messages.
Yes, this sounds so, hours and hours on this, yes.
We spent so much time on this language, and you're right back to where we were in the middle of this.
Sorry.
And No, I'm glad you brought it up, because welcome to the Transportation Committee last session when we got into the weeds of all the possibilities of when you push a button and talk, what does it mean? And I think that if you can suggest, Mr. Knott, a better way of getting there, I would certainly be amenable to other language. But I can tell you this gets very tricky. That's how we got into this sort of in the first place. And I would certainly, you know, we know where we're trying to get. It's getting there that is impossible, and the technology doesn't help us because it keeps changing. And so I'm open to suggestion on those issues because we struggled with them.
Representative Berger, we had a bill on interlock devices, and we heard testimony that they're going to blow into them while they're driving down the road. Yeah, they're required to. You think we ought to put something in there about them pulling off to the side or something? Because if it comes back positive.
Listen, my memory that they did have to pull along the side. They can't do it while they're driving. They have to keep. This is after they started the car, right? And they're driving. Then they pull off the side, I think, to blow into it.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, colleagues. It was a long, drawn-out conversation. I remember it clearly. And I can't remember, but, you know, the equivalent of impairment when you're texting, you may as well have a rather than the phone, you may as well have a bottle of whiskey in your hand.
That's right.
Be gulping it down while you're driving down the road.
I think people are innocent and they don't think they're going to harm anything, but you know they could easily kill themselves or someone else, and then they're tragic accident, and their loved ones are just left mourning, and it's horrible. And I just recently learned how to text too, and I won't be falling into any fountains anytime soon because I pull over first. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further, committee?
Thank you.
We'll stick around. Thank you. We have Kevin Campbell and Chief Jeff, is it Bowman? Bowen? Kevin, I grew up in Gearhart, and there was no police officer in Gearhart in those days, 47 to 53.
Thank you, Chair Krieger.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm the one that can talk. Chair Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 3186. We're also supportive of the capturing the issue of texting to make sure that's included in the bill. I'll be very brief because you have a lot to do today, but I will say there are our 250 members are supportive. Today with me is Chief Jeff Bowman from Gearhart Police Department. He's seen this firsthand, and what Representative Berger mentioned as a vague exception created all kinds of problems for law enforcement, and I think Chief Bowman can go into some detail regarding that, and in particular how there just wasn't a meaningful sanction for the kind of behavior, driving behavior, the chief and other law enforcement officers around the state were witnessing every day that represent danger to the public. So the brighter line distinction that this language provides is significant to us and important to us, and I urge your support for it, and I'll turn it over to Chief Bowman.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and Representative, for the record, my name is Jeffrey Thomas Bowman, and I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Gearhart. I've never testified before, so if I do something that's not quite appropriate or within text of things, it's not by any disrespect whatsoever.
Those of us from Gearhart can get away with that.
I may be titled Chief of Police, but actually I'm the daytime patrolman for the City of Gearhart. I go out and catch dogs, I investigate crimes, and I also write more traffic citations than anybody else, or probably than any chief in the city of, in the state of Oregon. January 1 of 2010 is when I started writing citations for the mobile communication device. People were shocked since that was the first day they said the law took effect. Well, in fact, it really didn't. It really took effect July 1 of 2009. It was just basically a six-month non-enforcement period for people to get their act together, get their Bluetooths, and do everything. Most of them failed to do so, and they're failing to do so today. As an example, when I'm sitting on the side of the road actually enforcing the mobile communication device law, people have tell signs that I can actually tell what they're doing now. When they're like this, they're either talking on the phone or they're listening to their emails. When they're like this driving down the road, I know that they're actually reading their emails or surfing the web. Some of them are even updating their Facebooks, or they're posting a Twitter. Okay. Checking your email is not texting. Twittering is not texting, and neither is updating your Facebook is not texting, as the industry has it as far as text messaging. In June of 2009, on average, there was 4.1 billion texts sent per day in the United States. In 2010, there were 50 million tweets per day being posted. Cell phones are really no longer cell phones. On my cell phone, I don't even have to have a computer in the office anymore. I can do my crime reports sitting in my car off my cell phone. I can do mobile banking. Again, if I had a Facebook account, I could do Facebook, and I could even tweet, or I could get on the radar trap site and post that I'm out there working it. In 2009, in the United States, there was 5,432 deaths that were related to driver distraction. 18% of those were related to the mobile communication device. Can you honestly blame that maybe 1,000 deaths was because of a cell phone? I don't know. But I can honestly tell you that the use of your cell phone did not prevent your death. The new phones that are coming out today, and they have been coming out for quite some time, it started in 1996. Nokia invented the first smartphone. The first BlackBerry came out in 2002. The first iPhone came out in 2007. These phones have the capability of acting as computers, just not talking on them. The new smartphones that are coming out today, they have two cameras on them now. One on the back for taking pictures and motion pictures. The other one is the cameras on the front, so we can be driving down I-5 at 70 miles an hour holding a video conference. Technology has outpaced our office, and it's outpaced our homes to where now it's in our motor vehicles. So I support this bill for the mere fact that if we can remove any cell phones legally from anybody's hands, it will reduce deaths, it will reduce injuries, and it will reduce property damage. Thank you. If you have any questions.
Members? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, I'm just curious, as mine does not have this ability, but what do you do with the cell phone that has the ability to tune in and watch a movie? Because we don't have a law right now that prohibits that.
Mr. Co-Chairs and representatives of the committee, technically, if you aren't following under the exemption and the cell phone's in your hand, I'm going to pull you over. Now, whether or not I can give you a citation for it or not will be determined as I'm conducting an interview with you on the side of the road, just as I have to do now.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
Okay, I hear that you're going to stop me, but I tell you I'm not on in the mode of communication with it, neither texting nor communicating with somebody on it, and I'm watching a movie. What are you going to do then with that?
I'm going to let you go down the road, and you're going to watch a movie, sir.
Thank you. We got problems.
Yeah, we
do. We got serious problems.
Mr. Co-Chair, on that point, it isn't limited to cell phones.
That's right.
There are displays that allow even drivers to be watching movies separate that aren't being broadcast through the instrument but are being displayed from a CD or a DVD. And that's as much of a distraction. Although I would submit that having a newspaper or book propped up on your steering wheel, which you can see driving down I-5 at 70 miles an hour or out on Highway 97 in the back hills doing 70 miles an hour, drivers do. So I support the very clear message that cell phones are inappropriate to be used for operating a vehicle. But I think we also have to remember that we have laws now that require you to be in control and responsibly managing your vehicle under any circumstance.
Thank you, Ms. Sharon. My daughter's high school, they banned all electronic devices. And if you're caught with it, they take it away from the student, and they call the parents, and they got to come down and get it. And the teachers have said it's totally changed, for obvious reasons, these kids and how they pay attention. Mm-hmm. It's helped immensely. But I suggest we make people, while they're driving their vehicle, store their cell phone where their concealed gun is out of the reach.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, just a very brief question. So my understanding, based on actually Representative Olson's comment, makes me wonder if like an iPod Touch that has data communication but is not telephonic, cannot send or receive telephone text messages, or something like an iPad, which would fit on your lap and if you wanted to read your email in the car, sure has a bigger screen, would not be covered by this bill. Is that correct?
I would not be able to enforce that, sir.
Okay.
Take a look at the amendments. Maybe we need some more amendments. If I may, we probably do need to take a look at an amendment if we're going to pass this law back out to make it work. And there are some laws now, Representative Nolan, unless they've changed since I've been gone in the last 10 years, that do prohibit a viewing device that the driver can see. The TVs and so on have to be in the back or supposed to be.
It was from the shoulder forward. You can't do that.
Yeah, Chairs Krieger and Barker, I was part of a bill a few sessions ago, and the reason it came up is I think General Motors had a new product that would allow the passenger to view a movie and the driver to view a blank screen from the same position, and it was a flat screen. And I remember going through a whole lot of amendments in order to get to the fact that we're trying to prohibit the driver from seeing anything, but we had to even create an exception for that because they figured out a way to make a flat screen that could be viewed from two different directions. So I remember the issue being discussed, and so committee counsel, not there may be some language with regard to viewing from the driver's seat, but I'm not sure if it would cover the devices that you referred to.
And if I can add to that, it's changed a little bit because of GPSs now. They are actually considered viewing screens.
Yep.
Representative Wong?
I'm just trying to get my head around conceptually what it is that we're trying to prevent. And maybe I can help sort this out in my own head by tossing this out. So the attention that it takes for me to adjust as a driver, for me to adjust the heat control is not dangerous enough for us to prohibit, and the attention that it takes for me to shift the radio station is not enough for us to prohibit. What are we trying to get at? Is it the attention? Is it the fact that the texting sucks me in, or the fact that the telephone conversation distracts me because it's an ongoing operation, or the movie because I'm watching something that's more interesting than the road? And I'm struggling conceptually with that issue, and frankly, how do we write it into a law? Because I think these are all instances where we get sucked in and it distracts us in a dangerous way, but I also don't know that we want to overwrite this such that I can't shift from 1190 to 750.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Mr. Elkins, Mr. Wagner, and Mr. McCarthy.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association, members of the committee. We appreciate being able to be here today. We're here to speak about the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3186. These amendments would continue to allow us to use cell phones while operating a tow vehicle or roadside assistance vehicle while acting in the scope of our jobs. On our jobs, we use all manners of communication, such as cell phones and two-way radios. When we are in locations where cell phones do not work, we need to be able to use two-way radios, such as CBs, walkie-talkies, or Nextel phones. We need to be able to communicate with a truck to the yard, the flaggers, and sometimes even law enforcement. We use all different types of communication devices, and we appreciate being exempted at this time under the current law, and we would appreciate being continued that exemption in the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair.
Co-Chairs Krieger and Marker, I'm Mike Wagner. I own Sandy M. Towing, up Highway 22, Detroit Lions direction, Dayton. I am a board member of the Oregon Tow Truck Association, past president, and I'm also the current chair of the ODAC committee. And so I spend a little, in my spare time, I do some, a little bit of governmental stuff. I heard a rumor I was on the school board, too, that I spend a little time on. But I certainly feel your pain in trying to understand this whole mobile communication, the whole electronics devices in cars, and how difficult it is to exempt them. I am, however, happy that everybody seems to think that the towing industry needs to have the ability to use whatever forms of communication we have.
cell phones have been accepted enough that they've even been written into most of the police contracts that I see around the state now. So it tells us we can use radios or cell phones now. And many times now we're talking to officers at the scene on a cell phone. That's not uncommon. The officer will call or want us to call and talk about what we've got or what we need, or, you know, trying to facilitate the communication process a little more rather than going through dispatch and tying up. Every time you get more people involved in the process, it gets worse to talk to people and get the message set apart. So I do believe that we're as professional drivers, I think that we're prudent in the way that we use those devices. The committee council brought up the two-way dispatching systems that exist, and most of those are, the guy that's driving the vehicle for the most part is receiving information, and he only sends information for the most part when he stops or is getting ready to start driving again. So there really are, you've either got to have it on a piece of paper to look at, or you've got to have a screen to look at. Somehow or another, you got to have information of where you're going and what address you're hunting and all that sort of thing. So I'd certainly be willing to help you with any questions you might have about our industry. I appreciate all the comments that have supported our industry to date. So,
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy with PGE. PGE is a vertically integrated utility serving 822,000 customers in the Northern Willamette Valley. They serve 52 cities and 6 counties. They have a service territory of about 4,000 square miles. We liken some of our glide crews to first responder types. They go out in outage situations and repair the electricity system that provides you with your electricity, or perhaps some of you with your electricity. I don't mean to make a claim for all of you. Our crews use, as the towing industry, a variety of technologies. We do use two-way radios. We do have an outage management system that involves a laptop actually in the crew truck that coordinates with our system at our headquarters. That's a like the police officers use in their vehicles, a regular keyboard. All of these things are used, in addition to cell phones occasionally, to repair and replace utility service. We do have internal policies in place that forbid the use of cell phones while driving. The two-man crews that are out there, we also have policies in place that the non-driver is supposed to be the one doing the radio or other outage work while the driver can concentrate on driving. We do, though, also have sort of our real first responders. We call them our Eagle crews. They're a one-person truck, and they're by themselves. So they need to figure out where the next spot is. Sometimes they have trouble locating where the outage itself is, and so they need a method somehow to communicate. I think the language in this bill can be construed that when the truck is parked, they continue running the truck in order to operate the man lift. They're on the side of the roadway. They're technically operating on a highway. We have concerns that even if they were stopped, that it could be construed that they were using these devices while operating on the highway. So we've asked for the dash threes. We think they're relatively narrowly tailored to the type of work that we're authorized to do under our franchise agreements with cities, of specifically installing, repairing, maintaining, operating, and upgrading. That's pretty standard language. In order to get just at that point, I don't want to come before this committee and suggest that my drivers driving 24,000-pound trucks hurtling down the highway should be able to use their cell phones when they clear that. That's not what I'm suggesting. But in order for them to do their work while they're repairing the lines, we ask for this dash three exception. Thanks.
Do committee members have any questions? Representative
Tomei. I guess my question would be to all of you, gentlemen, with all the new devices. I understand you're saying that some are required to have all kinds of devices, but don't they have all kinds of hands-free devices? And there's so many more new technologies out that would include hands-free.
My answer to that would be that they, especially as you get into the more remote areas, If I could just use the area that I cover, we have areas where our radios work and our cell phones don't. We have areas where they both work, and then we have some areas where we've got cell phone service marginally, but we don't have the other. The hands-free devices don't seem to have the clarity or the quality that the regulars do. We also are, sometimes we're receiving a message on the cell phone, not as us in the act of texting, but that's might be how we get the message that we need to turn around because the call canceled, or that we're looking for a blue Chevy instead of a red one, or whatever, you know. That sometimes some of the areas that we cover on Highway 22, we can get a text message when we can't get any other form of communication.
Follow up? That alarms me, because I thought that was the whole idea of the new bill, was not to allow texting under any circumstances.
We don't allow any of our drivers to come back to us, but if they hear the phone go off, they can pull over to the side and look at the message and see. It's one of the ways we communicate in a very environment that's not perfect for communications. But
follow up.
We certainly don't do this. You know, we're telling them when they hear the chime or whatever,
pull
over.
And read okay, yeah. Thank you. That's what I hear.
Can I just add on, co-chairs, Representative Tomei, I did, anticipating this question, ask about our radio system and whether there was a hands-free option, and apparently they're not with our radios. They don't. With the cell phones, yes, but with the radios, no.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything further? That's it. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Drew Hagedorn, Greg Campbell, and Adam Walsh, are they here? You're off? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Drew Hagedorn here today on behalf of the Oregon Transit Association, representing Oregon's transit districts, who are concerned this bill could apply to their dispatch systems and prohibit the use of their dispatch systems. So we're similar to some of the other concerns you've heard today. We'd like to work with the bill's proponents, Representative Tomei and Representative Berger, to potentially craft an amendment that would address that concern. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Adam Walsh with the City of Eugene. We also just have a small concern from our Public Works Department about language in the bill. On line 22, it references a person operating a motor vehicle while providing public safety services or emergency services as a volunteer. Our public works staff primarily uses a two-way radio for communication, but in some instances we'll have to use cell phones to complete their tasks, and perhaps just using the word including as a volunteer would satisfy our concerns, but I just wanted to raise that today.
Committee members, any questions? Thank you. Thanks. That's all that was signed up for that bill. Is there anybody else? Okay, then we'll close the public hearing on 3186. And open a public hearing on 3215.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3215 permits a court to approve a process for the payment of a class action settlement or judgment and directs court to order that any unclaimed settlement or judgment funds be paid to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the exclusive purpose of funding Oregon Opportunity Grants.
Chairs, members of the committee, Chris Garrett, State Representative from House District 38, Lake Oswego and parts of Southwest Portland. Thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3215. I'm happy to have a number of you on the committee actually as sponsors of this bill. And what this bill will do is make a simple change to Oregon's class action rules based on the principle that if a defendant is found to have done a certain amount of damage, a certain dollar value worth of damage, then that's the amount of money the defendant should pay. It sounds straightforward, and that's what most states do, and that's what the federal courts do, but that is not the law in Oregon. Oregon requires that if there's any money left over in a pool of class action proceeds, that money must be returned to the defendant. In some cases, what this literally means is that a defendant that is found to have, for example, overcharged several thousand people a certain amount of money on their telephone bill, cable bill, what have you, that defendant will actually get to keep the profits of its wrongdoing despite a jury verdict finding them liable for that wrongdoing. This doesn't make sense, and it doesn't do justice. The problem is that, practically speaking, in many class actions, the court can't ensure that the money will actually find its way to the class members. Many can't be located, or many simply won't fill out the paperwork. Realistically, how many of us would go to any effort at all to obtain $3 or $4 from a lawsuit? This bill deals with the problem the way 48 other states do and the way the federal court system does. It allows residual money to be allocated to a public purpose, the next best thing to getting that money into the hands of class members. In our case, we propose to send the money to the Oregon Opportunity Grant System to help Oregon students find access to higher education. That is what the bill does, and I'm happy to have it before the committee for consideration, and we have a couple of attorneys in the audience who I've worked with on this concept who will tell you more about how the rules work today and how this bill would change them.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee. My name is Susan Deegan. I am the administrator for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3215. Thank you for allowing me time to speak. I was asked to provide some background on the Opportunity Grant Program as part of my testimony today. The Opportunity Grant Program was established in 1971. I was surprised when I started writing my testimony and realizing that's 40 years ago. It is our only state-funded, need-sensitive grant program to help students with the greatest financial need pay for college. Students apply for the grant by completing the free application for federal student aid, also known as the FAFSA. It is the application form that is used not only for the Opportunity Grant, but also for federal financial aid programs such as the federal Pell Grant and the federal Stafford Loan, which is a student loan program. Eligible students must be Oregon residents, they must be undergraduates, they must be enrolled at least half-time at a participating public or private nonprofit Oregon college or university. Their awards are available for up to 4 years of full-time enrollment, and their awards are prorated, or their amount of eligible time is prorated if they're enrolled half-time. Students must also maintain satisfactory academic progress, and they must reapply for the grant each year to determine their financial need. We use a formula that's based on the shared responsibility model that was established by the 2007 Legislative Assembly to determine grant award amounts and student eligibility. The formula considers the average cost of education at the type of school the student attends, and it also considers contributions from the student, from the student's family, and from the federal government in the forms of federal student financial aid and tax credits. Maximum awards this year are $1,800 for community colleges and $1,950 for students attending four-year public or private nonprofit institutions. We anticipate having the same award amounts for the coming academic year. The awards will not increase, even though cost of education will be increasing. The purpose of the bill, as Representative Garrett has mentioned, is to forward proceeds that were for members of a class action, for those additional proceeds that were not awarded as damages, to be paid to the Student Assistance Commission for the purpose of the Opportunity Grant Program. We are aware that the proceeds from such cases can vary a great deal in dollar amount. They can be inconsistent from year to year. That complicates, obviously, our ability to be able to estimate annual proceeds. We would develop administrative rules and other strategies, such as creating an endowment that would allow us to mitigate the fluctuations of such proceeds. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be more than happy to answer questions.
Representative Schaffer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I greatly appreciate and support the Opportunity Grant. I think it's a great thing, and I would love to go out there and cut some more trees and put some more money in it. But that being said, if a judge comes along and says, Schaffer, you owe Representative Garrett $50, and I can't find Representative Garrett, and then my friend over here says, well, I think you should just give it to Representative Hicks because I think it's a great idea. And it could be a great idea, and he could be very deserving and needing of it. It could really help his family. But you know what? It isn't my friend's money to tell me where to give my money to. And if the judge was handed down an order, if you do not find Representative Garrett, you will give it to Representative Hicks. That's a horse of a different color, too. But we're dealing with somebody else's money here. We're saying you're going to take your money and give it over here to this great, wonderful program. And that doesn't add up for me. So I have problems with this bill, Mr. Chair. I know six of us are sponsoring this bill. I'm not one of them. And it probably has a fairly good chance of passing. Both co-chairs are on it. But I got problems with that kind of policy. I've shared this with a good representative. But I want it to be very clear, while we have the opportunity to grant people here, wonderful program. I support it. And I know if you get this money, you're going to put it to great use. And God bless you. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
I would say that about half of what we do in this building is taking money out of someone's pocket and giving it to someone else.
Mr. Chair, may I...
I was just going to respond to the good representative from Happy Valley. Understand that a class action lawsuit is not the same as a debt that or a breach of contract or negligence. By its very nature, a class action lawsuit is more in the nature of a kind of a private attorney general type of situation where the state isn't going to assert the authority to correct the wrongdoing, but private lawyers do. And the private lawyers do so because there's a lot of money in contingent fees for that kind of work because the damages can get so high. But we only allow it as a class subject to the supervision of the court. And that's why you get this type of a situation where it's not a constitutional issue to take damages paid in this way and why it's not exactly the same circumstance.
Ms. Chair?
I have a check at home. I was apparently somebody got in the computer and I was part of the class action suit for $4.80. I would gladly endorse that check over to the opportunity grant.
Anything further? Thank you. Jim Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, may I invite with me to join me the representative from the Oregon Liability Coalition?
Sure.
If he's still here. thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. And I also wanted to put on the record early two things. One, as a father of an 18-year-old who's desperately looking for any sort of funds to get him into college, I certainly, and so the association certainly supports the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. But I also wanted to let the committee know that, you know, business has become a little more organized in the last year, shall we say. We've discussed this bill among the business community twice now, and I can report that there is very little, if any, support for this legislation from the business community. I thought if I could, Mr. Co-Chairs, take a minute and talk about the history. This isn't a new issue. This issue has been around for a long time. This issue was first brought forward in a major way in 1981. And this is a bill that I kind of like to work every once in a while because I spent the whole morning at the archives. And if you haven't been to our state archives, I highly recommend it. Going through the research, and it was fascinating going back to 1981 because everything there is hand engrossed. So I would talk to the staff and say, you really don't realize how easy you have it nowadays, because it was all hand engrossed. The 81 session, I didn't put in the journal when bills were heard. They only put in there when they moved. So it took a long time to do the research and go back and look at this issue. And 1981 was really the last bill, and it was House Bill 3122, for anybody that's interested in going back and looking at the research, I'll save you that amount of time, that this class action statute was very broadly amended. I mean, there have been amendments over the years, but that was really the last big one. The gentleman that got me started in this business, Congressman Bob Smith, was a senator at that time. and served on the, they called it the Justice Committee as opposed to the Judiciary Committee. And he asked then Attorney General Dave Frohmeyer to opine on some questions about this bill, which the Attorney General did. And again, for those of you, and I'd be happy to provide the council with a copy, it was 36 pages of a letter that I didn't feel like making 25 copies of. I apologize for that, but I'd be happy to provide one to the committee council. Asked about this, what was then called fluid recovery. Now I think in the bill, or actually there's no reference to Cypre in the bill, but that's more of what we're trying to do here. But there was a lot of discussion and a lot of debate both in the House and Senate on that bill. And really what the big piece of that particular legislation was how individuals were going to be notified. Up until that point, as I understand it, it was up to the plaintiffs to notify and fine members of the class. This legislation back then put that onus or burden on the defendants, and the defendants had to go out and also help try to find the members of the class. This was also when we really developed the claim form that is in use until today for determining whether or not you are a member of the class or want to be a member of the class. So again, 1981, House Bill 3122 was really what got us here today or started us down this road. In 2005, then Attorney General Myers introduced Senate Bill 216 on this topic. He didn't come at it the same way. Basically, what he said is that the AG would be allowed to intervene on behalf of those of the class who failed to submit claims, and then they would then take that over. And he initially, when the bill was introduced, said any funds collected as a result of this would go into the general fund under something that was to be called the Class Action Recovery Account. That bill was heard several times in the Senate. I remind you, at that time, the Senate was 1812. 1812 Democrats to Republicans. And I figured I'd bring it down the record because that has changed over the years. But anyway, it came out of committee on a straight party line vote, and it was pulled. It got to the floor and was ultimately returned back to committee, never to be heard from again. And I will tell you, in the course of that bill moving through the process, it was determined in committee that it would no longer go to the general fund, but it would go to the attorney general. Or excuse me, it would go to the common school fund. So that was amended that way. It went to the floor and then was pulled from the floor prior to any debate or final action. In 2007, the Attorney General got a little smarter. He introduced the same bill, but this time he made it go to the general school fund, a common school fund, right away. So he didn't try to collect it for the AG or for his office, but to go to the common school fund, which is what at least the Senate Judiciary Committee wanted in 2005. In 2007, that bill did not receive a hearing. It was never scheduled. It did not move forward. 2009, there was not a bill introduced specifically on this issue, but you did pass, and those of you who were here will probably remember, House Bill 2585, which eliminated prohibitions on class actions so that you could file a class action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So there, what you basically, as I understand it, did was allow small claims to be aggregated into a class action and a class and then file and go forward. Again, the rules that we live under today were still in effect, and that bill was broadly opposed. It did pass the House, if you're interested, on a 36-21 vote. And again, no bill was introduced. So slow forwarding, on to HB 3215, the sponsor has gone a different way. What he's basically done is just eliminate the form completely. And I will tell you, and again, that doesn't necessarily make it right forever, but I will tell you this whole discussion over putting the form and requiring the form was a huge debate, has always been a huge debate, and is one that we would be very concerned if you simply pulled the form out. Because I think as Representative Garrett mentioned and Representative Schaffler, I'm sure we all get from time to time, and now we get them from email, hopefully not while we're driving down the road, Representative Olson, but we get emails that say, do you want to be part of this action? You're probably going to make $4.85. And I think where we have a philosophical difference is we, the business community, strongly believes, and the Oregon bankers strongly believe, that if I make a determination that, you know what, A, maybe I don't think the corporation did anything wrong, maybe I don't think I want the $4.85, or even if they if I believe they did make a mistake, I'm not going to try to collect my funds. That's a decision that they make, and that's what that form is there for, so that they can decide whether they want to participate or not. So to now say, well, these folks, for whatever reason, decided not to participate, we should go ahead and take that money anyway, from a philosophical point of view, doesn't make any sense. And again, we think what the worst thing this bill does is really undo that balance that has been on class actions in Oregon for many, many years. I could take hours and talk about where we think there are parts of the different malpractice and other suits that we think the trial bar has an advantage over the defense, but that's, we won't go down that road today. So again, we would strongly suggest that this legislation remain where it's at in your committee. If you do decide to go forward in your wisdom, we are in the process of having an amendment drafted that would basically say that the attorney collecting attorney fees under this action would make a similar contribution, a proportional contribution to the opportunity grant program, so that both sides have skin in this game. And I'd be happy to talk about that more later, or with each one of you individually. The last point I would make, and I do appreciate your indulgence in giving me the time to speak on this at some length, I would note that 3215 under the relating clause talks about appropriating money. And would strongly recommend to the co-chairs, or hope that the co-chairs would look at putting a subsequent referral on this bill to Ways and Means. With that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Well, I don't have any questions. That's okay. Please proceed. I'll ask when you're through.
Mr. Chair,
only to say that since I've generously offered my $4.80, I'm sure the proponents of the bill will offer something too, along the lines of the amendment.
Go ahead.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Deborah Herron, testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. And as you know, the coalition is a membership organization of individuals and businesses that are focused on two things where I'll identify concerns that we have with this bill. Our mission to reduce the cost of defending lawsuits and also improve the fairness and certainty of the civil justice system demonstrates that we must have some concerns about this bill, as we see 3215 as a means to allow for incentivization in pursuit of lawsuits that would also allow higher awards. So we would see this as an opportunity for more lawsuits with higher awards, because the thought would be that with a higher award, there would be more dollars that could go to the public agency, and we would just have concerns about the bill along those lines. We understand that there are amendments in the works, and we would be willing to continue to stay in touch with both proponents and the opposition to understand more about how the bill could change with amendments in place.
Committee members? I don't think it's so much a question, but there was a similar case a few years back that had to do where a company was cheating renters, I mean, out of a lot of money. So it goes to court, and there was a civil case on it. The people who were handling the money were found to have been cheating, and the company's ordered to pay it back. And part of that agreement on that particular case was the money who they couldn't return to the people who they couldn't find for, I mean, this was low-end people, would go to legal aid. So the case took about a year longer to settle because of that provision. But in order for an attorney to win that, I would have to assume the company had done something wrong, and so you get a judgment amount, and that's where that money is coming from. And I understand that less would go out if you didn't have to pay the unpaid amounts. I don't know what the unpaid amounts look like in these cases. I haven't really researched on that. And I would also... defending attorneys, but they do have skin in the game when they, you know, take a case on contingency. They a lot of times hang quite a bit out there. And I just, I want to take a close look at this rule, but I also think that if a company has cheated somebody, they are found in civil court to have cheated people, a group of people, that it makes sense to me that they suffer the penalty, the full penalty that's allotted. And I guess the whoever's assessing those could say, you're only going to be paying out half of that to the client, so we'll reduce the amount by half or whatever. But I'll have to take a harder look before I'm going to be a no vote on this. The basic premise I agree with, but I'll have to take a very close look at it. Thank you.
Representative Garrett?
So this is probably more of in the way of a statement, but I want to give Tim and Deborah a chance to respond. On Senate Bill 216 from 05, and I guess my first statement is sometimes it takes a while for a good idea to find its time, but this bill actually differs from 216 in a couple ways that you didn't mention. First of all, that bill was criticized significantly on the ground that it applied only to trials, not settlements. And it was argued that that unfairly prejudiced a company's decision to take its case all the way to trial. Well, this bill applies to both settlements and trials. Second, as you probably know, current law says that even if you're a class member and you choose not to collect your money, you don't fill out the claim form, you are not precluded from bringing your own action later. So this bill actually offers something to both sides. Yes, the defendant has to pay out the full amount of the verdict. The defendant also knows it's going to have peace because there is claim preclusion on class members who don't collect their award. And third, this bill doesn't involve the AG in any way. And there was additional opposition in 05 based on a perceived expansion of the Attorney General's powers. This bill bypasses the Department of Justice completely. It's a clean conduit, the money from the lawsuit to the opportunity grant system itself. So I would offer up those three differences as pretty significant differences between the 05 bill and this bill. And I guess I would close with a question about what is it that has caused the 48 other states not to see the wisdom of letting defendants keep the fruits of their wrongdoing?
Mr. Co-Chair Walker, Co-Chair Krieger, and Co-Vice Chair Garrett, I'd first like to address Representative Barker's, if I could, and then go on to yours. Under your example, and I think you raise a good example, because that's probably one where all the members of the class could be found. The question I think that is that becomes the important one is this class action dollar amount, is it a punitive penalty, or is it supposed to make the members of the class whole plus some additional amount for what's happened to them? As we look at this bill, we see this bill as saying you're not only going to try to make the members of the class whole, and for whatever reason, those that either can't be found or don't want to be part of the class, society says you ought to be punished for those folks too. And I think, as I say, it's a philosophical difference. That's where we come from. Now, addressing Representative Garrett, I agree, and I'm sorry if my testimony didn't make it clear, but this clearly doesn't have the AG involved in it at all, and you've come at it from a different direction. But what I guess I didn't make clear is the whole claim form program or procedure is something that again, it was a long time ago, but it was negotiated, and to this day, we consider it to be kind of a delicate balance and appropriate to stay in. I can't speak for the other 48 states. You know, I would put on an old lobby hat of mine and say, why are we the only state in the country that doesn't disclose expert witnesses? I mean, every state chooses to do things a little bit differently. So we have a procedure that we think has worked well for the business community as well as for the folks that are actually harmed and come forward. And again, remind you that, as you said, they can indeed go out on their own, but if the settlement is for $4.85, the example we've been using, it's hard to believe that somebody would go out and sue for $4.85. I mean, I'm sure they could, and some might. But and they might claim that they were harmed a lot more than the rest of the class, certainly. But we think we have a system that works well. Business, as I said, we have talked about the business community, broad business community has talked about this bill twice. It's one of the few bills we've talked about twice. I wish there was more of our colleagues here today talking on the legislation, but I can tell you that while we appreciate the efforts you've tried to make here to make it better, we're at this point not supportive, opposing the bill, but if we could talk to you about our amendment, maybe we could find that common ground.
I love to look for common ground, and I guess the argument in favor of this bill with the greatest merit is the Attorney General has nothing to do with it.
Anything further? I hope that ended it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have two more, Scott Shore and David Sugarman.
Afternoon, co-chairs Krieger and Barker, vice chairs, members of the committee. My name is Scott Shore. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm joined here by David Sugarman. We are attorneys. We often represent consumers and often in class actions. I wanted to give a little bit of background about current class action procedure and some testimony in support of the bill. We're passing out some written testimony, and I'll summarize it to some extent. House Bill 3215, as you've heard, it's a proposed fix to Oregon class action law that's presented in a fair way. It's got something for both sides, as Representative Garrett pointed out. First, it's intended to ensure that those who have been found by a jury to overcharge, to fraudulently charged, add-on charges of millions of dollars through illegal business practices do not get to retain their illegal revenues. They must pay for the full amount of harm that they've caused and that a jury has found that they've caused. Second, the bill ensures that if a class action lawsuit is resolved, either through a settlement or judgment, the defendant gets protection, and that's the end of the case for the defendant, unless there are a few opt-outs. Currently, someone could not submit the claim form and then later sue on the exact same theory against that same defendant, and that could happen multiple times. Here's how current class action law works and why it gets so tricky and why it's very different than an individual case. Under current class action law, a case may proceed to a jury, and a jury may issue a verdict for $1 million. That's on behalf of the class. But the way the current class action procedure works, you have to go out, give notice to everyone. That's controlled by the judge. These may be transactions that were cash transactions that happened years ago. It may be very difficult to find the harmed consumer from several years back who was overcharged $5, $10, $100. The court makes sure, because there are constitutional protections, that every effort is made to give notice to that class. There's an opportunity to file the claim form. But then the current procedure has to have you list thousands of potential consumers on the judgment. So, in my example, if there's $1 million verdict, we're only able to locate $100,000 in claims. Some people can't find the receipts. There are no receipts. They decide not to cash a check. They don't submit a claim form. They lose a check. There's only $100,000 in claim forms returned. There's a $900,000 difference, and the issue for this bill is what happens to that $900,000? Well, it shouldn't go back to the defendant that caused the harm. It should be used for some other just cause. After every effort is made to make sure the class members have an opportunity to receive it and don't. And that happens for a variety of reasons. People lose checks. People don't submit the claim forms. People lose the claim forms. People get checks but don't cash them. There's a lot of unclaimed funds in class actions that right now go back to the person that caused the harm, and that seems fundamentally wrong. The other aspect of this bill that I mentioned is it makes sure, and it's something for the defendants, if the defendant settles the lawsuit, if the defendant reaches a judgment, the class is stuck with the result that was obtained through the judgment. Class members cannot sue over and over again, which is an exception in our current Oregon rule of civil procedure. as Representative Garrett mentioned, we're one of only two states that does this. There's no real reason to return illegal revenues to a defendant that's caused that harm.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm David Sugarman. Just a couple issues Mr. Martinez raised that I thought might bear. Class action procedure is one of those kind of complex areas, and there's a misconception here that I think we really need to get at, and that is, in every class action, notice is given at a point, and every class member has the opportunity to say, I don't want to be part of this. It's called opting out. And so that procedure would still remain in effect under this bill, this amendment. I do also have, you know, some information that I've gathered anecdotally about, you know, what this looks like. The other thing that was raised that I thought was really interesting is the concern about cost of these procedures, and there is a case out there, and in fact, the other place where this has come up is in the Council on Court Procedures, on which I served several sessions ago. The Council on Court Procedures handles the procedural matters, but this is about allocation of money, which is really legislative. It's a line the council does not cross. But when the Council on Court Procedures last considered these issues, Judge Henry Cantor from Multnomah County Circuit Court provided information to the Council on Court Procedures that a claim form process in one case he presided over, the cost was $1 million. Okay, or nearly $1 million for a useless, nearly useless, I think were his exact words, process. So I understand the business community's unease about this, but I don't expect that this increases costs or fees, and in fact, there's good reason to think it decreases them. We're here mainly to answer your questions, technical questions about procedure or the policies that underlie. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shore, I am not a lawyer, I'm not an expert in this. I did read a lot of Grisham books. We're talking, your example you used, I can't imagine a law firm would want to would take this on and know that he's only going to recover 10% of what's available out there. So your example you used, I think, is not typical of what kind of money are we talking about here as far as how much is not going to be claimed. I think your example is skewed one way to
me. Well, I can address a little bit of that. You never know exactly how many people are going to return the claim forms, and that's really the issue. And the claim form percentage goes up, obviously, as the size of the claim goes up. So if it's a $500 claim, you might expect 30 or 40% of the claim forms to be returned. If it's a $10 claim, $5 claim, you might expect much less. And there's always a very sizable amount of unclaimed funds in all class actions, except where you've got records of every class member, maybe in an employment case. So the example really isn't at all unusual, particularly in consumer cases, that you might have a lower claim form and there's an amount of unclaimed funds. And the question is, what do we do with those unclaimed funds? There's every effort's been made to locate the consumer. There are illegal revenues from overcharging. Right now, those revenues go back to the defendant, and that makes no sense to me.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I think someone on this committee said, I think we've all been involved. We've had letters sent to us. Do you want to join this? But my question back to you is, your firms don't take these on unless they have a pretty good idea that they're going to get enough people involved to make it worth your while. I mean, that's capitalism. I support that. Is that not true? And again, you know, did I misread this? Did Representative Garrett not indicate he's looking like we're looking for $100,000 a year for the opportunity grant? Is that the amount of money? Did I hear that?
There's no fiscal
estimate of how much
the revenues we're talking about are so unpredictable and erratic from year to year. But I'm sure they can answer your question about how this affects attorneys' fees. You guys didn't really cover that.
Sure.
Yeah, let me handle it. Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Representative Wisenhat.
A couple things. First of all, there are two pieces in this. And the first, I think you're asking kind of two questions. One is this a realistic hypothetical? And it is, I think, is what you're really getting at. And the answer is yes. Let me explain why. As to your understanding that a firm has to be able to make money on this before they will take on a case, you are correct. But the calculation of fees, first of all, is set and controlled by the court. It is independently reviewed by the trial judge, the person presiding over the case. Number two, the court considers a number of different factors, including the amount of time, the result. There are 10 or 11 different factors in setting the fee. Okay, so the benefit on the class is one of them, but there are a bunch of others. In a lot of these cases, in the consumer cases, for example, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, there's a fee-shifting statute in there already. In other words, if the class prevails, the attorneys are entitled to attorney fees in a class action to be approved by the court. I do have some anecdotal numbers for you, and let me share my precise methodology with you. It involved me picking up the phone and calling people I knew who had cases. So this is what a statistician would say is a biased sample and all those other caveats, you know. But I was able to get numbers out of three different cases, and I'm talking to class counsel. And the first one that I'm going to throw out to you specifically talks about this. It was a class action against Quest. And class counsel, of course, this was several years ago. She had forgotten the exact numbers, but what she said to me was she believed that the claim rate was no higher than 15%. It was 10 to 15%. And that there was approximately a total of $80,000 to $90,000 unclaimed. Okay.
Mr. Chair, so I forgot. You gave me numbers. I didn't write them down. So it was a small amount, but still a small amount left over, too.
Exactly. Okay. But a lot of people, it was one of those classic small individual amounts aggregated. And a lot of people don't make claims in those. The $4.83 experience is very common, but philosophically what happens is if you don't want to be part of that, you always have the opportunity to do so at the front end and say, I don't want to be part of this. So two other cases I did get information on. One is...
We're going to have to...
I'm sorry.
Very brief. We've got another bill to run.
That's fine. Thank you. I don't need to go on.
We're probably
going
to have to come back.
Thank you.
Maybe amendment. Member Dave Garrett, that'd be all right?
Sure. Happy to look at them.
Okay. I appreciate you being here, and we will get back to this bill at a later date.
Thank you very much.
Close the hearing on the bill. Open the hearing on House Bill 3376.
And thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3376 has to do with the setting aside of criminal convictions. Under existing law, misdemeanors and certain Class C felonies are eligible to be set aside after a duration of time. House Bill 3376 would expand this to cover certain Class B felonies, meaning not person crimes, as that is defined by the CJC. They would be eligible for a motion to set aside if at least 20 years had elapsed from the date of the conviction sought to be set aside, or of the release of the person from imprisonment, and the person has not been convicted of any crimes in the interim.
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead and state your name. We are a little crunch for time, so I appreciate you keep that in mind. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I will attempt to be brief. I am Chair Barker and other members of the committee, colleagues. I am Chris Harker, for the record, representing House District 34, which is Beaverton and Cedar Hills. And I am here today to speak briefly about this bill. As all of you know, this is not an area where I have focused my attention before, but when I met the man seated to my right, Ben Price, and heard his story after he was introduced to me by a friend, I felt I had to get involved and see if I could help out here. And it may surprise you, but long ago, Merle Haggard was a big influence on my life, and when I heard this story, a song from Merle Haggard came back to my mind immediately. I have left the guitar in my office rather than bring it down here and play and sing to you, but I do want to quote Merle's lyrics from the song Branded Man. When they let me out of prison, I held my head up high, determined I would rise above the shame. But no matter where I travel, the black mark follows me, and I'm branded by a number, with a number on my name. Thank you, Merle. We have before us, I believe, a man who is a product of what we would like the criminal justice system to produce. And we have also here a lot of people who work in that system, as some of you do and have, who are going to speak more knowledgeably than I can about the process and about outcomes that are desired and the whole notion of expungement. And as I came into this process, I had conversations with several of you, a couple of whom decided to sign on to the bill, and learned that there is a much larger issue around expungement that many people feel should be addressed. We are not attempting to address that at this time. We are solely focusing on a little corner of it. But I have a letter from Bob Herman. All of this material has been turned into you already, but I would like to read just a couple of things into the record, if I may. Bob Herman is the district attorney from Washington County, my county. Some of you certainly know him. He defines what we are trying to produce here as an individual held accountable for criminal conduct that we never see again in the system is exactly what we hope to accomplish. And that is what we have here. He also states that having reviewed his county's record of B felonies covered by House Bill 3376, I continue to support House Bill 3376. I do not believe this bill would result in unintended consequences. Lastly, he states, I am authorized to represent that the Oregon District Attorneys Association is in support of House Bill 3376 as well. I have a letter from the Harris Law Firm, specifically from Robert J. Harris, who has been a lawyer in Hillsborough for 25 years, who founded the Oregon Defense Attorney Consortium, or ODAC, and he states, among other things, I support House Bill 3376 because it is a narrowly crafted revision to the expungement statute that rewards and recognizes rehabilitation and contains safeguards to protect the public from dangerous or repeat offenders. I think at this point I will stop and let Ben tell briefly his story that captivated my interest and those of some of yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Please go ahead, Ben. My name is Ben Price, for the record, and my address is 15347 Southwest 81st Avenue, Tigard, Oregon, 97224. Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and committee, thank you. I sit before you today as a Class B felon, which increasingly brings embarrassment to me as the quality of my life and the length of time between my conviction and now increases. This is something that comes up regularly for me today, that I bump into this conviction in ways when I'm trying to be of service to the community. One of the things, something positive that's actually come out of this is that I've had the opportunity, based on my experience, that this that created this conviction in the first place, which was absolutely merited. I have the ability to help those people who you know, are struggling with similar things that I had struggled with, you know, in a unique way that maybe other people in the community can't. One of the places where that's been an example for me is at McLaren Youth Facility. You know, I get the opportunity to go in there and talk to these gentlemen about the qualities of life they can have, because when I see these guys, they have an incredible fear about coming out into the world, if you will, with this felony, that they will never have a quality of life that you know, is really worth having. And I get the opportunity to go in there. It's through a different program. I'm not going in there to tell them about my success story per se, but I get the opportunity through the ventures that I do there to tell them and show them, you know, that I've had a really great life today. you know, barring this extreme embarrassment that still hangs with me, this was 23 years ago, over 23 years ago that I received this conviction, and it was distribution of cocaine is what the charge was. Something that is, one of the things that's really been on my heart, if you will, is I met through my son getting ready to become an exchange student through the Rotary program. He was the only, the one and only picked through the Tigard Rotary to go abroad, and he went to Brazil a couple of years ago. One of the things that happens in that process is I had a lot of exposure to these Rotary members who were at my house, and we fed them and, you know, and had a lot of exposure with them, and they started asking me if we'd be a host family. One more time, my heart went. One more time. This is 20 years after my conviction. One more time. And they asked, about the fifth time they asked me, I said, here's the deal. One more time, I had to reveal this to you know, people in the community who trust me, who appreciate me, who respect me. One more time, I had to reveal this. I'm a felon. Nobody's going to allow a felon to have, you know, nobody wants their son or daughter in your house, you know. And what I got to do as a result of these people having known me for a couple of years at this point in time, they said, you know what? We know you, we know your family, and we think you should still put your name in the hat. The officer called me who does their background checks and said the red flag came up, as you said it would, but yet they still want to pursue that. So, in fact, we were able to host a wonderful young lady from Argentina, and you know, and that was just a beautiful experience for our family that our family almost didn't get to pursue or get to enjoy because of that. If those people had not known me, it never would have happened. But through the experience of knowing me, it was able to happen for our family. I hope I'm not going too fast. I'm pretty nervous up here.
You're doing fine.
Thank you. There are areas in my life that are still seriously affected by this felony charge of, you know, over 23 years ago. And I really, really have the passion to participate in ways in the community that I just can't do. I'm just not allowed to do. I say again, at the time when that conviction was, when I got that, it was absolutely merited. It was the right thing to do in my life for the court systems to do what they did. A room very similar to this, my family sitting behind me as they were then 23 years ago. In a very different kind of capacity. Today they get to see, this is unbelievable. I'm a convicted Class B felon for the distribution of cocaine, and I'm sitting here before you today with the opportunity to say, you know what, enough is enough. You know, I really, really have the opportunity to bring myself to this community in a much larger way than I am. I'm in construction, as many people are who are in similar situations to me. It is not my passion to be in construction. I have other passions, and I'm not allowed to participate in those as a result of what has happened here over 23 years ago. So, in closing, I guess, I'm asking that you support House Bill 3376. So that I and people like me can pursue our passions in the community in a way that we'd really like to do. I promise you I pose no threat. thank you, and I would thank you, committee. I would welcome any questions that you might have.
Yeah, thank you for coming forward, and I really appreciate it. I didn't exactly run with the safest crowd as a youngster. But for the grace of God, God knows what. So I made a lot of bad decisions as a youth. I don't have a felony record, I'm grateful to say, but I can appreciate what you're going through and your frankness and your openness. It's Mr. Price, right?
That's correct.
Mr. Price, here let me. We run up against this trying to, if a child's taken away from a home, you know, if these red flags can come up, perfectly good people, they haven't been in trouble for decades. It's not just you, I can assure you. But my here's I think the hang up. You're a good, decent citizen. You made your mistake. You paid. You know, you paid your debt to society. I trust you. I believe you. And we waive or get rid of and expunge your record. I'm confident nothing bad would happen. But the hang up is, and you've probably heard this before. We pass this bill, and I'm not saying I'm against it. I'm just saying we pass this bill, and one person, just one, goes out and screws up after we've expunged their record. We put them in a position of responsibility of a child. And now it all just blows up. It's incredibly sensitive. I don't know if you would like to respond to that, or some of the members would like to respond to that, I'd be appreciate hearing that. Looks like
Mr. Chair,
Olson's interested.
Yeah, there is a mechanism in place here. Even though, what we're talking about here is a B felony. It just doesn't exist. And actually, Representative Hicks might be able to weigh in on this a little bit too. But the mechanism to protect this is that if Ben were to go forward with this, if he were eligible, he would have to go in front of a judge and then have to plead his case on why he's even able to move forward. And it's the judge at that time then determines whether or not. So there's a screening process here. I've sat in and I've watched several of these here this last few years so I could get a better idea of what's going on with our expungement laws. And we need some serious, serious work to fix that. So I'm just throwing that out.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for your testimony, we'll move on because we're really out of time. Some people are going to have to leave for other committees. But I am going to ask Felton Howard Jr. and I'm sorry, Alvin McCoy, if they could come up, and they'll be the last people to testify today. We'll finish up tomorrow. I'm sorry, Mr. Norris and Mr. Rockerode, but if you want to stick around, we'll go ahead and have your testimony since we're not doing the work session. I don't want you folks to have to come back down. Please go ahead, just when you identify yourself by name on the tape recorder for the record, please.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon, chairs and committee members. My name is Felton Howard, Jr., and I'm a navigator for the Reentry Transition Center. I work for Mercy Corps Northwest. I'm here to support this bill, 3376, and I also have the same exact conviction that this gentleman here has. Actually, he's a bit of an inspiration to me because I've only got 6 years under my belt of, good behavior here in society, and I'm hoping to be able to last for this 14. He's an inspiration. I work with people that are recently released from prison and people that are on probation and parole. I have the job that I wanted to get, and it just so happened that part of the criteria for the job that I needed was that you had a criminal record. It doesn't happen very often. Otherwise, I would have had the same problem he had trying to do a job that I wanted to do. And part of besides helping these individuals reintegrate back into society, my coworker and I offer support and mentorship for these individuals. And part of the mentoring piece is assuring the participants that living a life free of drugs and crime is beneficial not only to them, but to society also. Forgiveness is one of the basic tenets of our society. This is one of the things that happens. And it starts out when you're a child. You do something wrong, your parents punish you. Eventually, you put in the time and they forgive you. Sometimes it's hard for us to convince some of the young men and some of the young women that we work with that they will eventually be forgiven by their loved ones and by society for the things that they've done. And what I would like to see happen is that you guys pass this bill and give these people, it'll give them a long way, give them how would I put this? Okay, let's say passing this bill will go a long way towards giving them another goal to achieve in their life. And to tell you the truth, I'd like to be forgiven myself, for what I've done, And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to let me speak. And after you speak to my coworker, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Well, Mr. Howard, I just want to say that while Mr. Price is an inspiration to you and all of us, you're certainly an inspiration with 6 years to new people coming out of prison. Because 23 years seems like a long way down the road, but they can say 6 years, and then hopefully they can move on. And so I really appreciate the work you're doing to help us save people. You're really making people know that we're saving.
Yes, sir.
Kind of discussion yesterday. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. McCoy, please.
Hi, my name, good afternoon, Chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the community. My name is Alberta McCoy, and I'm also work for Mercy Corps Northwest at the Reentry Transition Center as a navigator. And I'm here today to testify in support of Bill 3376. On behalf of myself and the ROTC and hundreds of more individuals that I work with. I've been a taxpaying citizen for 22 years, and unless someone had given me the courtesy of another chance to prove myself, I too could have ended up in a vicious cycle. If folks who have shown 20 years of stability by changing their criminal behavior, their barriers, according to this bill, should be changed. I'm asking today that you please pass the bill and help folks get back to living a normal life and that they be forgiven for what they've done.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And up on the panel, there's three people who are career police officers, and we've seen through our lives successes that we're, you know, you see people you have no hope for and they're younger, and then, boy, we're really pleased to see the end result. Thank you again for your testimony.
All right, thank you, sir.
Okay, and as you can see, we're running out of people, but Mr. Harkle Road, Shannon Wright, and Dan Norris, please. Yeah, Mr. Norris, can we clear back over again? So.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'll go ahead and start, keep it moving. The few members of the committee that are here. I indicated I'm neutral on this bill. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. What I did is I thought I'd try to be helpful to this committee, and hopefully some of these lists that I'm about to hand over, Shannon, if you'd do that, thank you very much. I appreciate your help. What I did was I got a list of all of the B felonies from the Criminal Justice Commission. And then I went through and I highlighted in yellow the non-person ones, and that's the list that's coming to you. And as I had chance to read that list, I realized that I had highlighted the last one, and it's a person felony. It should not be highlighted, okay? So I made a mistake. But because I knew I might make a mistake, I also attached the list of all of the person felonies in the state of Oregon as the third page. So you can see just exactly from this list, basically, should you decide to do this or not to do this, what a B felony is. And I thought I could be helpful then to provide that. So hopefully you can explain it to the other committee members. I'm done.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Barker, I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney in Malheur County, members of the committee. I hope I'm not being rude. I'm testifying by cell phone so I can keep it short. The first thing that Ms. Kushwal wanted me to make sure was very clear is the DAs are in support of this particular bill and are hoping that, as Representative Olson said, the other set aside issues will be taken up in the interim. With that said, this is a very narrowly tailored bill that is good policy. I can tell you anecdotally, I have a woman who embezzled $500,000 from the community college. And after 20 years, she would be able to set that conviction aside. So we're not talking about de minimis crimes. They are serious crimes. However, if she can go 20 years and be crime-free, then we should remove the barriers that would hold her back. And we allow people to have their firearms rights back after 15 years. We don't convict or we don't impeach them on the witness stand for felonies after 15 years. So this is very consistent policy. Thank you.
Hi. For the record, I'm Shannon White with Partnership for Safety and Justice. I will be very quick and just provide you with a few facts that might be helpful in your consideration of this bill. We are testifying in support of the bill, and we are, to remind members, an organization that advocates both for people who have been convicted of crime and victims in crime, and carefully consider our membership of both those constituents when we weigh in on bills. And we do believe that this bill, while it clearly is targeting helping people who have convictions break down some of the barriers to employment in particular and housing, that also we believe that when people are meaningfully employed, they are less likely to commit future crimes, they are more able to pay restitution to their victims, and that's why we come in support of this bill. I do want to just give you a few facts to consider. One is that this year in Oregon, 4,000 people will be released from our prisons and jails. The Pew Center on Public Safety has found that 1 in 100 people in this country are under some sort of correctional control. In Oregon, that's 1 in 33 people under some sort of correctional control. So I do think it is wise for this committee to consider how we are enhancing success since such a large number of people are impacted by the correctional system and these kinds of barriers. And another just quick national statistic that is interesting is that the Center for Economic Policy and Research found that a prison, that the a felony conviction or being incarcerated had lowered the total employment rate for men in this country by 1.5% to 1.7%, and that in GDP terms came out to about $57 to $65 billion in lost output. So there are some very serious consequences for the kinds of barriers people face. We know that people need to be held accountable. They need to pay restitution to victims. We do think this bill is carefully tailored in a way that it provides strong public safety and accountability.
Mr. Knott, does this bill, as part of the provision of non-crime, also see to it that all restitution has been paid?
Chair Barker, to be eligible for this in any event, I mean, one of the thresholds for motion to set aside is to satisfy all terms of the agreement to the court's satisfaction, so I'm confident that would be included.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, panel. And with that, we'll adjourn.